This is the takeaway for Tuesday, October 17th, 2017.
This is the takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. Thanks for spending some time with us today.
I don't feel anything but hopeless, and it seems like something I'll just have to live with now.
Women across America are speaking out on social media and on our show about their own experiences being sexually harassed. The Nation has spent a week with the story of yet another man using a position of power to intimidate and exploit the women around him. The Harvey Weinstein story isn't the first, and it isn't the last, from Roger Ailes to Bill O'Reilly, Bill Clinton to Donald Trump. But is the country finding new ways to reckon with a festering problem? Social media platforms lit up with the hashtag MeToo as people stepped forward to acknowledge their experience with sexual harassment and assault. And you've been calling in to say Me Too as well.
Hi, this is Maddie from Salt Lake City, Utah.
This is Laurie in Oakland.
Hi, my name's Jay. I'm calling from Miami, Florida.
I would really rather not broadcast my name or the town I'm calling from.
And a note, many of these stories are difficult to hear.
I thought he was my friend, but when I was asleep after a night of drinking, celebrating his birthday, he raped me. I was confused and physically incapable of defending myself. He refuses to acknowledge what he has done, and I didn't file a police report because I don't think anyone will believe me.
Like almost every woman I know, I've been sexually assaulted and harassed. Most significant was decades ago at the University of Miami, when I was drugged and raped by a football player in the backyard of a college party.
When it happened, I did not report it. Of the four girls in my family, all four of us suffered sexual abuse, two by strangers and two at the hands of men they were dating. I think only one of those was reported.
I have been a victim of rape. I've also been a victim of sexual harassment at work, like most women.
Your voices on your experiences with sexual harassment. Well, when it comes to workplace sexual harassment, the entire concept didn't really make it into the American mainstream until the mid-70s. Our friends at Retro Report have been looking into the American history of sexual harassment from 1974, when the term first emerged, to how the country deals with the issue today. Bonnie Bertram is a producer with Retro Report. Bonnie, welcome back.
Oh, good to be with you.
Well, the phrase itself, sexual harassment, Bonnie, seems like it's always been part of the lexicon, but really it hasn't. When did the term sexual harassment arrive on the American scene?
Well, of course, sexual harassment's been going on forever. And what happened in 1974 was a woman was teaching at Cornell University in the Human Affairs Department, and she had been tasked with this course called Women in Work, where she would examine how women were faring in the workplace because they were entering in large numbers in the 70s. For the first time, baby boomers were rushing into the job market, and a lot of those people were women. So in the course of talking with these young students, she realized that every woman in that class had experienced losing their job or being demoted because they had refused the advances of a male boss. And she kept thinking, this is bizarre. It's happening everywhere. And she said that everywhere she went, she would just pull a woman aside and say, have you ever experienced something like this? And she realized how pervasive it was. And she said, we've got to name it.
I was going to talk about something seriously that heretofore had been a joke in the culture. I remember thinking, well, they'll either laugh or they won't.
And so she helped come up with the phrase sexual harassment in the workplace to describe what women were experiencing.
Bonnie, that's the mid-70s, and then you go forward to the mid-80s, and there are these important milestones in the cultural and legal concept of sexual harassment. In 1986, there's a Supreme Court ruling on harassment as discrimination. What did that case do?
That case put businesses on notice in a new way that if they had a workplace where women were experiencing this kind of harassment or a hostile workplace, or in fact, what was common at the time, it almost seems incredible now, but a boss would say, I'm not going to promote you unless you sleep with me or do something. And what that Supreme Court ruling did is it said that it was a form of discrimination and that it violated the 1964 Title VII Civil Rights Act.
And after that case came down, did workplace practices change significantly? Did it have a big impact on the culture?
It had been bubbling up in lower courts for years. But what happened when the Supreme Court ruling came in 1986 was that it really put the onus definitively on the businesses, that they had to take proactive steps to try to prevent this from happening. And if they didn't, and women experienced this, there would be a price to pay.
Well, Bonnie, we talked about the mid-70s. We talked about the 80s. And then at the beginning of the 90s, came Anita Hill, 1991, testimony in front of the Senate in the confirmation hearings for Justice Clarence Thomas, which really rocked the culture.
The comments were random and ranged from pressing me about why I didn't go out with him to remarks about my personal appearance. I remember his saying that someday I would have to tell him the real reason that I wouldn't go out with him. He began to show displeasure in his tone and voice and his demeanor, and his continued pressure for an explanation. He commented on what I was wearing in terms of whether it made me more or less sexually attractive. The incidents occurred in his inner office at the EEOC.
How did the Anita Hill experience and the Clarence Thomas experience impact the culture of sexual harassment?
Well, I have to say, we were doing this report soon after those Billy Bush tapes had emerged of President Trump and the way he was talking about that woman and groping her. So against this backdrop of that moment happening and some women feeling like, oh my gosh, I can't believe this man's behavior, and then yet women voting for Donald Trump when they went to the polls, I think in a way it was a similar moment because the nation was divided and all of the coverage at the time said, he said this, she said this, who do you believe? There was a real sort of galvanizing moment on side of people who said, I can't believe Anita Hill's being treated this way, and I can't believe he's being confirmed to the bench anyway. And on the other hand, there was a group of people who, I mean, not to use the parlance of today, but there was this notion of boys will be boys and that sort of locker room attitude. So what it did to the country was it really brought it out of the shadows when they heard Anita Hill talk about it, and it galvanized them. And a lot of women suddenly realized that they had the responsibility to call out this behavior when it happened. And so the number of filings of sexual harassment claims to the EEOC more than doubled in the next few years.
And Bonnie, where your story ends and what Anita Hill says is that the reaction now to stories of sexual harassment, often that involve famous people because this is a celebrity culture, that reaction is now swift and overwhelming and condemning.
It is, but Todd, you know, when you look at the long view, I mean, Time magazine, the cover of the Anita Hill hearing says, we're at a watershed moment. And I'm sure when that 1986 Supreme Court ruling came down, a lot of women who didn't want to handle this abuse anymore cheered that moment too and said, wow, finally we've got a definitive ruling on our side. So I would just caution that this does seem to be a particularly relevant moment, and we've heard words like tipping point and watershed, but I would just caution that the long view of history would tell you that this might not be our first watershed moment on this issue.
Bonnie Bertram, producer with Retro Report, with a new piece on the American cultural and political history of sexual harassment, right on time. Bonnie Bertram, thanks for coming back.
Oh, thanks for having me.
You can see Retro Report's documentary on our website at thetakeaway.org. And let's head to Somalia now. After this weekend's truck bombings, rescuers and volunteers are digging through debris for remains. Hundreds are injured and many are still unaccounted for, and the government says they expect the death toll to rise past 300. No one has taken responsibility for the attack, but Somalia's government is blaming al-Shabaab. They're an al-Qaeda-linked Islamic extremist group in Africa with a long history in Somalia and in the region. In 2013, the group was blamed for an attack at a mall in Nairobi that killed 67 people, and back in 2015, al-Shabaab targeted a series of hotels in Mogadishu, killing at least 15 people. Kevin Seif is Africa Bureau Chief from the Washington Post, and he has the latest from Mogadishu.
The death toll just continues to go up. I mean, the attacks happened on Saturday evening in Mogadishu, but they were so big and the destruction was so massive that it's taken a long time to figure out who's still missing, how many people have died. I mean, right now, I think the total is over 300, but it continues to rise. So people are trying to identify family members. There's a huge blood donation campaign going on because a huge number of people are wounded and sort of on the edge of survival. So, I mean, it's incredibly bleak in Mogadishu right now, even in a city that is used to car bombs, is used to big attacks. This is by far the biggest attack they've ever seen.
Is there a message coming from the leadership of the country to people in Mogadishu and around the country about how they'll react here?
You know, the president has declared 3 days of national mourning. There's been a sort of sense from the leadership across the Somali government that they're trying to crack down, trying to improve security. But it's been so many years of these kinds of attacks. I mean, this is a particularly dramatic one, but I think many Somalis, particularly in Mogadishu, have sort of lost faith in the government's ability to provide security, to keep al-Shabaab, the sort of major Islamist group, from conducting these kinds of attacks in broad daylight in major hotels. And so the government has a real challenge ahead to try to convince people that, you know, Mogadishu, you know, for a long time, there's the sort of slogan of the government was Mogadishu Rising. And there were pictures of people on the beach playing soccer and eating at outside restaurants. And this idea that, like, the war was fading away and normal life was returning. It's really hard for the government to promote that narrative now after an attack like this.
And indeed, the president of Somalia, Mohamed Abdullahi Mohamed, took power in February promising that very thing, that he would bring the country out of conflict with al-Shabaab.
Exactly. And he had the support of the U.S. behind him, too. I mean, the president of Somalia is actually a dual citizen. So he, when he came to power, there was a sense that he would be, you know, a very sort of helpful partner with the U.S. in cracking down on terrorism, improving security across the country. And I think what this attack shows is that that's just an incredibly difficult thing to do. I mean, the U.S. has had a counterterrorism campaign in Somalia that's gone on for the better part of a decade. There have been drone strikes that have killed multiple leaders of al-Shabaab, this organization that was responsible or most likely responsible for this attack. And yet here we are. So I think even a counterterrorism campaign as concerted as the American one, even a Somali government that is saying all the right things, comes up against, you know, one of the biggest challenges, I think, in East Africa, which is an incredibly powerful terrorist organization that appears to be well-financed and well-resourced.
What is it the United States needs to be thinking about now in Somalia?
So I think the U.S. has been trying very hard to develop a Somali security force that can fend against this sort of a threat. You know, a security force that ideally would have been able to stop a truck bomb like the one that we saw, a security force that could conduct its own offensive against al-Shabaab. And that has been, I think, one of the biggest failures in the history of the war in Somalia. I mean, it is an absolute failure. There is still no functional Somali military. The Somali police is wildly corrupt and often accused of human rights abuses. So at this point, there's no Somali force that you can rely on to do the sort of basic security work, the kind of basic counterinsurgency work that needs to happen in Somalia. And I think until that sort of local force is created, there's really no substitute. There's really no way that the U.S. with a bunch of drone strikes and airstrikes can pacify the country.
Kevin Seif, thank you for joining us.
No problem.
Kevin Seif is Africa Bureau Chief for The Washington Post. The dual truck attack in Somalia over the weekend is undermining stability in that country. Somalia is already struggling with famine and drought while trying to overcome a decade of violence by the Islamist terrorist group al-Shabaab. With some analysis now, Peter Pham. He's director of the Africa Center at the Atlantic Council and co-author of Somalia, Fixing Africa's Most Failed State. Peter Pham, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me, Todd.
When attacks like this happen, Peter, the victims suffer horribly, of course. The rest of us are left to look for the messages embedded in that attack. What did you see in this devastating launch over the weekend?
The thing I saw primarily was that beyond the obvious concern for the victims, it was the reminder that al-Shabaab is a remarkably resilient organization. This is a group whose roots go back several decades, whose current form perhaps dates more recently, but it's proven remarkably resilient. It's adapted to changes in the political and security environment of Somalia and the neighboring region and transformed itself each time to survive. And it's recently been under a lot of pressure. Just a few years ago, Shabaab controlled two-thirds of the territory of Somalia, and the government was barely confined to a few buildings in Mogadishu and the airport zone. Since 2011, through the efforts and sacrifices of the African Union peacekeepers, Shabaab has been gradually pushed out. And through recent strikes by the United States and others, its leadership ranks have been decimated, but it has adapted and less interested now in seizing and holding territory. That hasn't proven to be a winning strategy, so it's engaged in these terrorist attacks. This is by far the deadliest, but it's not the first one. My count is the explosions this past weekend were the 34th time car bombs had been detonated in Mogadishu since January of this year. 34 car bombings. It's an amazing number.
So as you're saying, and as we heard before, tactics shift, al-Shabaab still is showing it has the ability to inflict enormous damage. What about strategically? What can al-Shabaab do now to really undermine the government or undermine stability in Somalia?
A couple of things. One is, one has to acknowledge that the current government under President Farmaajo is arguably the best chance that Somalia has had in years, if not decades, to reestablish some modicum of stability. That being said, one has to be realistic and clear-eyed. This is not a government that is without its warts. The Auditor General of the government acknowledged that somewhere up to $20 million exchanged hands in the process of creating this government as people literally bought offices. That's not a regime that is likely to engender much support or to be able to fight. In order to fight a counterinsurgency and win against a group like that, one has to have legitimacy. And what Shabaab is aiming to do right now is to undermine the tenuous legitimacy and hold of the government by showing people that you may have a government, but it's unable to deliver security for you. And that's a devastating message.
We're talking al-Shabaab and terror in Somalia with Peter Pham of the Atlantic Council. This is The Takeaway. Peter, the United States has been focused largely on ISIS, places like Syria, Iraq, even Libya. Has Somalia been neglected?
I would say Somalia actually has gotten a fair amount of attention. There were a number of drone strikes as well as a few raids during the Obama administration. And earlier this year, the Trump administration loosened a bit the rules of engagement, devolving more authority to the commanders on the ground, those closer to make decisions. And as a result, there have probably been about a dozen drone strikes or other actions involving U.S. assets in the region. And they've not been without effect. In July, there were two drone strikes that took out two key regional commanders of al-Shabaab. Just last month, about a dozen militants who were planning a terrorist attack were eliminated. So there have been some successes. On the other hand, I think the attack this weekend, as well as the ones that preceded, also underscore the limits. Counterterrorism strikes of this kind, these military strikes, can certainly eliminate high-value targets and take out forces. But what's needed is policing and security and intelligence to fight the new game that Shabaab is playing.
Is the United States doing enough on that score then? Policing and intelligence, sort of what I'll call the ground game of counterterrorism strategy, and not necessarily relying simply on drone strikes.
Well, here's the rub. There's a lot the United States and its other international partners who have been involved, especially our European friends in Somalia, can do. But at the end of the day, the only way stability and security are going to return to Somalia is if the Somalis themselves take ownership and there's a government that's capable of that. And that's where we hit some real problems. To give you an example, over the last few years, the United States, as well as its principal European allies, the French, the British, as well as the European Union, acting with a host of smaller countries, have trained somewhere between 60 and 80,000 troops for the Somali government. Yet if you go out there and try to count the ones you can find, there are probably only a few thousand. So that means, you know, maybe 10% of those who are trained are still serving the functions for which they're trained. The other 90%, where have they gone? Some of them quite possibly have even gone over to the enemy. That's a real problem, and that's not a problem that the international community can solve. It's a problem that the Somali government needs to solve.
Meanwhile, Peter Pham, we've been reporting for weeks, months on this show about the famine in Somalia and countries around it. Draw the line before we let you go to connect that political crisis of the famine to the terror that we're seeing in Mogadishu.
Well, it's certainly, that's yet another thing that undermines the legitimacy of the government. And this is why it's important not only to feed people because it's the right thing to do, but also reinforces the legitimacy and stability of the government, which is really, for all its warts, our bulwark against al-Shabaab.
Peter Pham, director of the Africa Center at the Atlantic Council and co-author of Somalia, Fixing Africa's Most Failed State. Peter Pham, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me, Todd.
That's the sound of Iraqi government troops in Kirkuk yesterday, celebrating the lowering of the Kurdish flag and the raising of the Iraqi flag. Iraqi forces took back the contested city, as well as valuable oil fields nearby, 3 weeks after Kurds overwhelmingly backed independence from Iraq in a referendum. Both the Iraqi government and Kurdish forces are key U.S. allies, though, and both are armed and trained by the U.S. in the fight against ISIS. President Trump had this to say about the clashes yesterday.
We've had for many years very good relationship with the Kurds, as you know, and we've also been on the side of Iraq, even though we should have never been in there in the first place. We should never have been there, but we're not taking sides in that battle.
The president taking no sides in that battle between Iraqi forces and Kurdish forces. Emma Skye oversaw Kirkuk as governor coordinator for the Coalition Provisional Authority from 2003 until 2004. She's also author of The Unraveling, High Hopes and Missed Opportunities in Iraq.
I don't think any prime minister in Iraq can afford to lose Kirkuk. Kirkuk is a key city. It's a contested city. And it matters not only to the Kurds who want to incorporate it in Kurdistan because they see it's essential to their independence, but it also matters to Baghdad. Kirkuk has got a mixed population of Kurds, Arabs, Turkmen. Some of those want to be part of Kurdistan and some don't. And Kirkuk has a lot of oil.
So what's the prevailing imperative here? Is it the oil and the resources or Iraqi cohesion?
I think the imperative is to find some compromise on the way ahead. Everybody told Barzani not to go ahead with this referendum. And he was thinking that this referendum would help him with leverage to negotiate separation from Baghdad. But he overreached by including Kirkuk within that referendum. So I think the imperative is to look at what compromise can be found. I think a compromise is possible. And that compromise could be looking at whether Kirkuk could have some special status, jointly administered perhaps by Baghdad and by Kurdistan, and to have some sort of mediation through those disputed territories to work out which districts should be part of Kurdistan and which districts should remain part of Iraq proper. And this could help pave the way perhaps for confederation between Kurdistan and Iraq and to lower tensions across the region.
And what about the American position behind the scenes in the private diplomatic rooms? I mean, the United States was clear before the referendum it did not want the Iraqi Kurds to separate.
The U.S. told Barzani not to go ahead with the referendum. And I think they were believed that Barzani wasn't going to go ahead with the referendum. So they told him not to. And then when he did, they were shocked. And I think their attitude is that Barzani has created this crisis, but with the US playing no role, if you like, in mediating between the different groups, that's opened up the space for Iran to be the mediator. Iran has been supporting the different popular mobilization forces, which is Shia militia, which have been supporting the Iraqi government forces to take Kirkuk. And Iran was also putting pressure on the PUK to do a deal with Baghdad. So the hand of Iran is there in the background, helping the Iraqis and pressuring the Kurds to do a deal.
Iran finds a way to increase its influence in Iraq yet again as Kurdish forces and Iraqi forces clash over the city of Kirkuk. Emma Skye, Coalition Provision Authority 2003 until 2004. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
We continue our ongoing coverage now of the opioid crisis in America. And we have some news out of Washington. The president is expected to officially declare a national emergency next week to address the opioid crisis. But the leadership of that initiative is now in question. Republican Congressman Tom Marino of Pennsylvania was President Trump's pick to be the next White House drug czar. Now, Marino has withdrawn his name from consideration. This comes after an investigation by the Washington Post and 60 Minutes found that Marino pushed for legislation that would make it harder to rein in drug companies that manufacture opioid medications. Joining me now is Lenny Bernstein, a health and medicine reporter for the Washington Post. He co-authored that initial investigation for the paper on how the drug industry weakened the DEA's power in this arena. Lenny, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hi, Todd. How you doing?
I'm fine, thanks. Lenny, how did Tom Marino, this congressman from Pennsylvania, go from being the president's pick for drug czar to suddenly withdrawing his name?
Imagine, if you would for 1 second, Tom Marino as drug czar going into a town hall meeting in southern Ohio or West Virginia where people have dozens and dozens of people have lost relatives to opioid overdoses and trying to credibly speak about controlling drugs in this country. They would tear him apart. It couldn't happen. And I think that was quickly realized.
Take a minute, Lenny, and detail some of the allegations, some of the findings, both in your story and in the 60 Minutes profile that helped get us here.
Sure. The main thing that Marino did was, at the behest of drug companies that did not like the law that was being used against them, he carried a very onerous version of that law that made it almost impossible for the DEA to use their most powerful weapon, the ability to immediately suspend drug shipments, against companies, mostly distributors, manufacturers in theory, but mostly the very large companies that distribute drugs to the places where you and I consume them.
The idea here is it just made it easier for drug companies, but mostly distributors, as you say, to flood the market with prescription opioid medications.
It made it easier for them to ignore the DEA. Under the law, they are required to report suspicious orders of drugs. And that's a great idea. If a pharmacy is ordering 20,000 pills 1 month and 100,000 pills the next month, the DEA wants to know about it. Well, the only way they're going to know about it is if the big distributor who takes the drugs there tells them about it, because the data is immediately available to that distributor. Under the law, they're required to do that, but they didn't like it, and they didn't want to have to do it. And maybe it was because they were making so much money at filling these giant orders of drugs. So the DEA cracked down on them. They went and got the law changed.
But it raises the question of vetting in the first place and why the president or the Trump administration thought that Tom Marino, given his history working at the behest of the drug industry in this way, was the right person for the job.
All through this story, we have been astonished at what people didn't know. This law passed both houses of Congress by unanimous consent. No congressman, no senator raised a fuss saying, this is a really bad idea. Let's not do this. President Obama signed this law, and yet his staff at the OMB and at ONDCP said, no one told us this was a bad idea. We had no idea. This was sent up to us as a non-controversial bill. I find it completely credible and yet at the same time amazing that Tom Marino wasn't vetted in this same way, that the Trump administration didn't know that he carried this bill, and that the DEA fought him for 2.5 years before finally acceding to their wishes.
Well, what does this say then about the power of the drug industry, whether it's manufacturers or distributors, as the government, the president, and the nation searches for a solution to this crisis?
I'll just quote Joe Ranazzisi, the fellow who blew the whistle on all this. He says that the drug industry has influence right now that hasn't been seen in American government. I don't know how to measure that, but I know that they have a tremendous amount of power and influence in this game.
Lenny Bernstein, covering health and medicine for The Washington Post. Thanks a lot, Lenny.
Thank you.
And if you missed it, you can find our hour-long special on opioids in America and all of our continuing coverage of the crisis. That's at thetakeaway.org/opioids. It's The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. And this week's case in point involves judicial misconduct, jury misconduct, police misconduct, and prosecutorial misconduct. All of those grievances affected the fate of Rogers Lacaze. He was an 18-year-old African-American man from New Orleans in 1995. Rogers Lacaze was convicted of murdering a white police officer and two other people and given the death penalty. He spent the last two decades in legal wrangling that made it all the way to the Supreme Court. And earlier this year, justices told the Louisiana Supreme Court to take another look at the case. I spoke to Blythe Taplin, senior attorney at the Capital Appeals Project, who is now co-counsel on Lacaze's case, and also Andrew Cohen, who you heard from, senior editor at the Marshall Project and author of Case in Point, about this series of alleged errors and poor judgments that resulted in Lacaze being sentenced to death after only a three-day trial.
It's New Orleans. You have a black defendant. He gets an attorney who is hired essentially for the cost of a used car, who has no experience in a capital case. There's very little pretrial work done on behalf of the defendant. The judge is sort of in a sour mood. The judge and the defense lawyer don't get off to a good start. There's actually a contempt finding against the lawyer, which probably chills his ability to do his job. There's a co-defendant in the case who is also a cop. In a cop killing case, the co-defendant basically points the finger at our defendant here, and he really had no chance in the trial. There was some self-incriminating statements that he made after what he says was police brutality. That wasn't explored before and during the trial. And so you have what you usually have in these sorts of cases, a quick conviction and a death sentence.
What about jury selection?
Jury selection is where things really go off the rail. One of the jurors who was asked the question, do you have any ties to law enforcement, was a 911 dispatcher who was working on the day of the shooting. She does not disclose that fact during jury selection. She attends the funeral of the dead cop, the victim in the case. She does not disclose that fact during jury selection. Another person who makes it onto the panel, who sits in judgment on this defendant, is a longtime police officer. He's been on a related force, or I guess a police force in the neighborhood or in the area, for over 10 years. He does not disclose that fact to the lawyers or to the judge when he is asked questions about his ties to law enforcement. And finally, another juror makes it onto the panel who had lost two siblings in a murder. So ask yourself the question, if you were ever a capital defendant in a case involving a dead police officer, would you want two people with such close ties to law enforcement to sit on your panel? Of course not. And the fact that they lied to get on the panel, they failed or refused to disclose that information, is jury misconduct, and I think is a strong case for a new trial. Let me also just now briefly tell you about the judge. The judge in the case had problems because he had signed a warrant, if you will, allowing the murder weapon to leave a police locker in the hands of a police officer who reportedly then gave it to the co-defendant in the case, the cop who we think, or some people think, actually did the shooting. So you have a judge who is a witness who basically allows the potential murder weapon to get into the hand of a co-defendant, who then denies that he signed this order, and who then believes that none of this is grounds for recusal. None of it is even grounds to allow the defense to make a recusal motion because the judge doesn't tell the defense lawyers what's happening.
Blythe, is this a classic case of incompetent counsel? It seems like a case that would have been ripe for a mistrial.
Certainly it is a classic case of incompetent counsel when you have someone who has absolutely no experience doing capital cases and really little experience in general with murder cases, you know, talking about jury selection. This was someone who didn't even understand how to do voir dire, jury selection for a capital case, and had asked a friend of his to do it for him who was unrelated to the case. Jury selection took 3 hours, and I believe the attorney who did it said at the beginning to the jurors, "The defense attorney has asked me to do this. I don't know why, but I said yes." And then he left immediately after jury selection.
And then, Blythe, as we go over the long history of this case, after the conviction, after the criminal part, this case has gone in and out of appeals and in and out of the courts for many years. Help us understand why.
Mr. Lacaze was convicted in 1995. He filed a direct appeal with the Louisiana Supreme Court, and he lost there. It wasn't until 2008 that he started sort of his post-conviction proceedings, which is in front of the same judge that presided over his trial. We filed in 2008 a motion to recuse that judge, but unfortunately, the recusal proceedings took a couple of years. Finally, the judge was recused from the case and we had an ad hoc judge put on it. And a new trial was actually granted in 2015 on the issue of jury misconduct. But then the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeal, which is the Court of Appeal here in Louisiana, reversed that. It then went up to the Louisiana Supreme Court, and the Louisiana Supreme Court denied relief in December of last year, and that's when we took cert to the U.S. Supreme Court. And it was this month that the U.S. Supreme Court granted cert and sent it back to the Louisiana Supreme Court.
And now that the Supreme Court has sent it back down, what might this mean for Mr. Lacaze?
This crime was committed with a 9mm gun that was never recovered. The police department in New Orleans realized very quickly that the co-defendant in this case, who was a New Orleans police officer, had obtained guns from the evidence and property room. She obtained a 9mm gun from a court order that appeared to be signed by the very judge who was hearing our case. That judge was approached by internal affairs officers on multiple occasions and asked to give a statement, asked to give handwriting exemplars. There was an investigation into this. And the judge sat on this trial of Rogers Lacaze and said nothing. We don't need to prove in this case that the judge was actually biased, but simply that the probability of bias is too high to be constitutionally tolerable. And we believe that it is.
Andrew, we've talked about so many of the twists and turns in this case dating all the way back to 1995. Is there a broader policy implication in your view here?
I think the broader policy implication is just the failure to acknowledge a mistake, the failure to acknowledge what is not a close call here. And to me, one of the larger implications here is that it took this long to get the U.S. Supreme Court involved, and I'm not sure this case is over. I'm not sure that the Louisiana Supreme Court is going to be so willing to follow the spirit and the letter of what the U.S. Supreme Court has essentially asked it to do. It wouldn't surprise me if the state courts that have basically denied this man relief for decades continue to try to do so for a few more years.
The case of Roger Lacaze, convicted in 1995 of a triple murder in New Orleans, headed back to Louisiana after a decision by the U.S. Supreme Court. Andrew Cohen, senior editor at the Marshall Project, author of Case in Point. Thanks, Andrew.
My pleasure.
And Blythe Taplin, senior attorney at the Capitol Appeals Project. Thanks to you.
Thanks a lot.
When President Lincoln signed the Emancipation Proclamation in 1863, African Americans owned less than 1% of the total wealth in the United States. 154 years later, that number has barely changed. White families have 13 times the net wealth held by black families. That's according to the Survey of Consumer Finances in 2013. One proposal for fixing this huge wealth gap? Black-owned banks. By investing in them, African Americans keep money within their own community. And the idea goes back centuries. Mirza Baradaran is associate professor of law at the University of Georgia. Her new book is The Color of Money, Black Banks and the Racial Wealth Gap. In the book, she explores the wealth gap and the dilemmas of black banking back to the Freedmen's Bank created after the Civil War.
The Freedmen's Bank was the only sort of relic of Reconstruction era reformers' efforts to help the freed slaves that survived to get some, you know, capital, some stake in the land that they had been working for centuries. And it was the only bank ever created by Congress for private citizens. And it was created as a savings bank so that freed slaves, you know, they weren't going to get land, but they would get a savings bank and they could deposit money in there and buy land. And so it seemed that it would be supported by the full faith and credit of the government and that it would be backed by the Treasury. It was not. The bank failed disastrously. It wiped out 60% of the freed slave savings.
Well, how long was it then before there was another real effort to form black banks and to consolidate black capital?
Yeah, so it was decades later. I mean, it was funny, right? There was this dual effect of the Freedmen's Bank. One is that there's this lack of trust of banking institutions, but the other is propaganda efforts of the Freedmen's Bank really impressed upon the black population that banking and savings accounts was the way to wealth. It's decades later, black communities across the South are saying, we need our own banks. Jim Crow segregation was rampant. Blacks could not invest in white institutions, and so we're going to create our own. And these banks were, you know, quite successful and robust and led to this, you know, heyday of black banking between 1910 and 1930. So during this era, there were hundreds of black banks formed all across the country in these segregated black communities. And so this was the height of segregation, and it was also the height of black banking and a real renaissance in community building in these black spaces.
Well, those banks were so successful amid the injustice of segregation. Why didn't they flourish past the 1930s?
Because you can't seclude people and bar them from real sort of the actual sort of mainstream arteries of capital. It just doesn't work. So they were successful in drawing in deposits, but they were never able to do the magic of banking. And so the mechanism was broken because of segregation, because of Jim Crow, and because of widespread exclusion from commerce.
Toward the end of the civil rights era, President Richard Nixon, Republican, was a big advocate of black banking as well, really tried to promote it, but he seemed to believe in it to an extent. Talk about Richard Nixon and how he viewed black banking.
Yeah, so Nixon is, it's a fascinating and ironic twist to this black banking saga, which is that his response to black power is black capitalism. And what Nixon meant by black capitalism is, okay, we're not going to integrate. We're not going to give reparations, which were what the black power groups were demanding. We're going to give you black capitalism. You are going to own the businesses of the ghetto, and you're going to just, you know, use the rules of capitalism to build wealth. And so he gives, you know, very weak, by the way, support to these black banks and black businesses in the ghetto. He puts, you know, some government deposits in these black banks. He does the SBA loans, which, you know, the Supreme Court finds later to be a discrimination to white firms. He starts affirmative action. So this is his whole bundle of black capitalism responses. There was no capital in black capitalism. There was no real state support of these industries. But the thing with black capitalism is that it was incredibly successful politically. And it also ends up leading to this sort of libertarian free market idea of, and we're not going to help these communities. We're just going to allow them to compete in the free market. And what I point out in the book is actually that's only applied to black spaces, because the way that the other, you know, surrounding areas outside of the black ghetto had gained their wealth is through these government programs that had been ongoing from the New Deal until the 60s. And now that blacks were saying, okay, well, we want a part of this, you know, capital credit structure, Nixon said, no, pointed to the free markets and sort of wished the communities luck.
Well, I want to talk about the state of black banking today, because it was just about a year ago, you know, we covered on this show the bank black movement, which took off on social media and elsewhere too. Almost overnight with that movement, $1 million in new deposits in black banks. And since then, estimated $60 million into black banks because of the movement. Has it been a big success? And what does it say about the overall health of black banks today?
I mean, look, this is an industry that was decimated by the financial crisis. There were, you know, over 50 black banks before 2008. Now there are about 20. Most of them are still kind of limping along. This is not an industry that's robust. And part of it is because, you know, the way that banking works, you really need a strong capital base. And most of these banks serve a community that still suffers from concentrated poverty, is still 30 years, 40 years post-civil rights, is still segregated mainly. And so the mechanism of banking is not going to save these communities. I get the urge for bank black. You know, I deposit my money in a black-owned bank. I get that urge, and I think we need to be supporting these institutions because they're the only ones really committed to closing this wealth gap. But they can't be the only ones sitting in the room. They can't be the only ones doing it. There has been this, I think, myth that the problems of the black community are just problems of free markets, right? That they're, you know, low-wealth communities because of a lack of initiative by blacks. There's, you know, family values. There's all of this language that blames the lack of wealth on the black community itself. And if there's any myth that I want to dispel, it's that is not the cause. The cause of the wealth gap is structural policies that we have made through banking, through credit, through redlining, through Jim Crow, and institutional racism that has created this wealth gap. And when it was time to pay attention to it, you know, in the late 60s and until now, a lot of times white policymakers responded with free market responses. This is how we've dealt with segregation in the ghetto and concentrated poverty is, oh, we'll give you this micro lending program. We'll give you a community bank. And this is not just Nixon. This is Reagan and Clinton and Obama and Trump. You know, every policymaker's response to, you know, these pockets of concentrated poverty is small banking. Yes, bank black for sure, but I just want for this time, you know, instead of just relying on black banks, that we all sort of wake up and say, this is not just their problem.
The book is The Color of Money, Black Banks and the Racial Wealth Gap. Marisa Baradaran is Associate Professor of Law at the University of Georgia. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
And today we have some sad news to leave you with for fans of the cult hit Trailer Park Boys. John Dunsworth, otherwise known as Sunnyvale Trailer Park Supervisor Jim Leahy, died yesterday. He was 71 years old. Dunsworth had a long career on stage in Canada, and then he hit it big when Trailer Park Boys became an instant binge classic. His character Mr. Leahy and his beloved Randy battled over 11 seasons and multiple films with Ricky, Julian, Bubbles, and of course, the liquor.
Take the bus. Listen, Mr. Leahy, they could kill one another.
Wouldn't that be nice?
Yeah, but we can't be involved with murder.
Exactly, Randy.
Mr. Leahy, is this you talking or the liquor?
Randy. I am the liquor.
Canadian actor John Dunsworth, a funny, funny man. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Staples, offering print and marketing solutions for businesses, including color copies and presentations, booklets and manuals, signage, and more. More details at Staples stores or staples.com/copy and print. Staples, it's pro time.
PRI, Public Radio International.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.